It seems to me that we're on in slightly different climates. I'm in a t-shirt and it's bundled up. Like, it depends on various things, how we feel. I was remembering the time that I lived in a Zen monastery, and the somewhat unique way that the time for meditation was announced. You know, here we have a bell. It's very nice. It's, you know, but in this valley where I was living, you would hear something like this, and then. It was it's called the roll down, and it was the sound made by a hammer, kind of mallet, you know, hitting this wooden block called the han, which was hanging outside of the meditation hall, outside of the zendo. And, you know, so it was a monk or, you know, we called men and women both monks. And but because the valley was kind of long and deep, they'd have to really, you know, they would just boom, boom. And so there would be this roll down would happen a number of times. And on that piece of wood that was being struck with the mallet was a verse, a poem. And it was painted with kind of black ink on the han. And the poem was something like, "Great is the matter of birth and death." So the first line is, "Great is the matter of birth and death. Life is fleeting, gone, gone. Awake, awake, each one. Don't waste this life." And, you know, so whenever I would walk into the meditation hall, I would always stop and read that verse. You know, great is the matter of birth and death. And it was so wonderful. And just this reminder of that this is a practice that addresses birth and death, to understand birth and death, and the kind of poignancy of being called to meditation, you know, with this question, out of this question of birth and death and change and impermanence. And in a way that this literal kind of verse on impermanence, which was bringing us into the meditation hall, kind of suggested or kind of reminded us of the fact that often it's the truth of impermanence that brings us to practice. You know, something about the nature of change, something about the unpredictability and uncertainty, instability in this realm, this human realm, that opens us to practice, that we kind of, we want to some way find a way of learning to be happy in this world of change, learning to be free in this world of change, learning to be at ease in this world of change. So I think of this as kind of a koan of impermanence. And this has been an important koan for me in my life. And certainly, even though maybe I wouldn't have put it in these words, so it's something that brought me to practice. And this idea that the heart of our practice is in some fundamental way how we meet change, how we meet impermanence. And one of the things we often say with Dharma practice is that it's not so much about the what, but it's more about, come on in, but it's more about the how, you know. The what meaning all of the particulars of our life, all of the, you know, the contents of our life. We have some control over this. We have some agency, but probably less control than we than we like to think. You know? And deep down, in some way, we know that. But this question of how can I be with this? How can I meet this? How can I relate to this? In this how, in this relationship, is the place where we suffer, and is the place where we can be free from that suffering. So this question of how do we meet change? How do we meet impermanence? Is kind of the heart of Dharma practice. And there is, you know, there are many stories and koans and about this, but one that I would like to share to start with is a pretty famous koan about facing impermanence. And so it's the main character in the story is Master Ma. In Japanese, he's called Basso. And Master Ma was famous in Zen lore for being a really big, powerful, strong Zen master. And so a lot of the stories of the master kind of shouting and kind of cutting through stuff is like stories about Master Ma. And this is a short koan, and the basic gist of it is that Master Ma was unwell. And not only was he unwell, but he was quite ill. And his student came to him and asked him, Master, how is your health these days? You know, so he's very sick. This very fierce, mighty master was quite ill. And his student came to him and said, Master, how is your health these days? And Master Ma responded, Sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha. And that's the story. Sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha. To give a little context for this, in the mythology of Chinese Buddhism, a sun-faced Buddha is a Buddha who lives for a long time, 1,800 years, according to what I read. And a moon-faced Buddha is a Buddha who lives for one day and one night. So, he says, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Long life Buddha, short life Buddha. And I find it very touching. It's that one lives for a very long time, and one lives for, you know, just this briefest of moments. And they're both Buddhas, you know. They're both awake. They're both connected. They're both here in some way. And I was thinking about this story And that recently I got the news that one of my teachers seems to have a cancer, you know, or is, even though he doesn't look sick at the moment, you know, it is a quite serious illness. And he is 90 years old, you know? And I was in a meeting with, I happened to be with him in a meeting, a surgeon who was going to offer one possibility of a kind of treatment. And, you know, in the kind of matter-of-fact way that a surgeon says, he says, well, you know, if you tell me you're ready to leave this world in 6 months or 3 to 6 months or 9 months, I would say, forget about surgery, just go enjoy your life. You know, what? Months? What? Huh? And so 90 years is kind of a long time to live in our scale of things. But yeah, so I thought, I looked at him and I said, are you a sun-faced Buddha or a moon-faced Buddha? You know? And so maybe we could say that the sun and the moon stand for the changing conditions of our life. But then what does it mean to say sun-faced Buddha? Moon-faced Buddha, you know? Or maybe we could say healthy Buddha, sick Buddha, happy Buddha, sad Buddha, anxious Buddha. You know, usually we wouldn't think, how can there be an anxious Buddha, right? Buddha wouldn't feel what I feel. Must be totally different, right? But I think what this koan is suggesting is that there's a way that while acknowledging the changing conditions of our life, there's a way of relating to that change in that each thing, each state, each moment is completely itself. It has its own kind of perfection. It has its own kind of purity. So when the teacher says, when I'm healthy, when I'm strong, when I'm a vigorous Buddha. And when I'm sick, when I'm dying, when I'm frail, I'm a frail Buddha, you know? And this willingness to completely be what we are in the moment, you know, it has this flavor. And that takes a lot of acceptance, a lot of letting go, a lot of courage, you know. This afternoon, I was meeting with some of you in the practice discussions, and I have to say, I enjoyed them so much. They were so beautiful and so touching to me and so stimulating. They just felt like these wonderful conversations and these wonderful meetings. And for me, it was like each person came in and each person was different, right? Of course, completely different. Different energy, different appearance, different history, different conditioning. So there was this change. This is the kind of the side of differentiation. But then, at the same time, each person was a Buddha. Each person was perfectly themselves, you know, and was completely there and completely expressing themselves. You know, it was so beautiful. It was, so this for me is the flavor of sun-faced Buddha and moon-faced Buddha. And I guess it's a question for us, is what is it that's liberating, might be liberating about this perspective? You know, I think usually we have the idea that practice is about getting from here to there. It's like, you know, polishing floor, scrubbing something to be completely clean, completely free of dust. But this is kind of saying, how purely can we experience each moment, no matter what it is? You know, how purely can we allow ourselves to open to the full range of human beingness, of human experience? And so what for me is so moving about this is the permission not to have to spend our whole practice or our whole life trying to become something we think we should be and trying to not be what we are. And so this kind of like that maybe the perfection that we're looking for is found, the perfection that we're seeking is found in how we look, not in what it is, not in what's happening, but it's a way of looking, a way of looking. And so another question, is the peace of the Buddha some kind of unchanging state, you know, that we're trying to achieve? Or is it a kind of openness to all states? You know, I think about one of the great gifts of retreat practice, you know, what we're doing here, is that when we meditate again and again, and sit again and again, and walk again and again over the course of a day, over a course of a week, we just cycle through everything. We cycle through good feelings and bad feelings. We cycle through joy and sadness. We cycle through times of calm and settledness, and we think, okay, really getting somewhere now. You know, and then the next sitting, oh my God, I got back to this, and you know, this again, and so there's a certain kind of equanimity that can emerge when we sort of get that, okay, you know, sometimes it's going to be like this, sometimes it's going to be like this, and you know, we're not that bothered by it. It's like, oh yeah, okay, huh. Okay, it's like this, huh. Okay, the mind's doing this. And this is great, this very, I think that that's an important kind of milestone in our practice, when we're less engaged and seduced by the content of our meditation or the content of our experience. And there's this kind of, okay, you know, part of this is in my control, but a big part of it is not in my control. The mind is going to do what it's going to do. Other people are going to do what they're going to do. But I'm just going to keep coming back and keep showing up. So this idea of the heart of practice as facing impermanence. And I think one of the paradoxes of this is that, you know, unlike learning some other skill, like learning the cello, like my daughters play the cello, learning to play the cello. And, you know, it's a skill, and they kind of they either practice or they don't practice. More often they don't practice. You know, please practice a little bit before your next lesson, you know, just so we can say you practiced. But it's, you know, it's its own discrete thing. When you think about something like impermanence, impermanence is not something that happens later. You know, it's not something that, oh yeah, huh, impermanence. That's an interesting idea. You know, we're in the midst of it. We are it. It's all there is. It's all we are. So it's, but, you know, in a way, it's like, it's the water that we swim in. It is the water. It is the fish. It is the air. It is the bird. But it's so close to us that in a way we don't, you know, maybe we don't fully recognize it for what it is. So this paradox of we're in the midst of it, yet we need a lot of support in a way and a lot of help of how to open to this, how to meet this, how to navigate this and find our composure in the world of impermanence. So some of the things that, so what supports us into opening to uncertainty, unpredictability? And the interesting thing is that it turns out that what helps us to open to what's changing is actually stability, is structure, is, you know, I think about my children and I don't know, I have a little bit of an image of myself as a free spirit and, you know, I don't want to be tied down by routine and rules and this kind of thing. But after having kids, it's amazing. I mean, the life I live is so structured. We wake up at the same time every morning. We have the same kind of breakfast. We do the same thing. At night, we have the same bedtime ritual. Take the bath, do this, do that, do, you know. And what I realized is that in terms of helping children to become, you know, people who are able to meet the world and be in the world and be curious and adventurous and confident, it's very helpful to have a place where there's predictability, there's structure. They know what's going to happen. They know. And in that, there's a kind of safety. You know, there's a security. And from that secure attachment, they can meet the world. You know, if the home life is very chaotic, very unpredictable, unstable, I don't know if my parents are going to be nice tonight or angry. I don't know if they're, if we're going to have dinner or we're going to have to figure something out, or, you know, that creates a different kind of conditioning. So in a little bit of the same way, to open to change and to open to impermanence, it's helpful to have structure. I mean, if you think about Buddhist monastic places, which are, in a way, their mission is dedicated to meeting impermanence. They do the exact same thing every day. The schedule is exactly the same. And they've been doing that for hundreds and hundreds of years, you know? So, you know, is there a way that, you know, in retreat practice is clearly like that, that we have this structure. And is there a way that it, something in our life, some way of living our life, can be structured in a way that gives support, that gives this kind of support to meet life as it is? I also think of the structure of the meditation posture, you know, to have you know, we don't talk about it that much in the insight world, the Vipassana world, but to have a good posture, this strong back, and the stability of sitting, this kind of intention to stillness, is very helpful. And then we say that a mind that moves a lot, you know, I don't know about you, but for when my mind is very busy and very stirred up, the world seems solid. The world seems fixed. My problems seem like, oh God. But when the mind is quiet, when the mind is calm, when the mind is still, then it's easier to perceive what's changing. It's easier to perceive this world of impermanence. So impermanence, meeting change. The possibility of seeing the perfection in each moment of change. This is a long introduction, but an introduction nonetheless in the piece of the Genjo Koan that I wanted to talk about. Firewood becomes ash, and it does not become firewood again. So this is our usual understanding of time and of change. You know, it's the flow of things. This is the teaching of the Dharma, right? You know, nothing at all has unchanging self and this flow thing. So firewood becomes ash, does not become firewood again. And now Dogen continues, yet do not suppose that the ash is future and firewood past. You should understand that firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood, which fully includes past and future and is independent of past and future. Ash abides in the phenomenal expression of ash, which fully includes future and past. Just as firewood does not become firewood again after it is ash, you do not return to birth after death. So what I think is Dogen, what I think this is about is that Dogen is offering us one answer to this koan of impermanence. You know, how can I be in this world of change? What is it to be in this world? Everything is like arrows going in one direction. Firewood becomes ash. Birth becomes death. Youth becomes old age. Health becomes sickness, right? This is like these arrows of time. And how can we be in this world? And what Dogen is saying is, yes, this is true. Yes, time flows this way. But also, it's very important to understand and experience that, you know, he says firewood has its complete existence as firewood. You know, firewood is only firewood. Firewood will never be something other than firewood. In the moment that firewood is there, firewood is just firewood. And so our life flows, our life changes, but once it's changed, we become fully that. And in that moment, we're fully that. So firewood is fully firewood. Ash is fully ash. So, I mean, the way that I understand this is the flow of impermanence is a kind of continuity. But then each moment is this kind of discontinuity, of kind of just this. And for Dogen, the present moment is the only true reality. So in the moment that firewood is firewood, this is, it's not only firewood, but it's the whole universe. It's past and future. Maybe another way of saying it is that you know, it's like when we're young, our life has its full expression as youth. And when we're old, our life has its full expression as old age, you know? And it's we're very oriented around this language of becoming. So Dogen says, birth is an expression complete in this moment. Death is an expression complete in this moment. They are like winter and spring. You do not call winter the beginning of spring, nor summer the end of spring. But actually, we do call we do call summer the end of spring. We do feel that, you know, very much feel that health turns into sickness. We very much feel that youth turns into old age. And so I think the challenge here is to see that the fulfillment of our practice, the fulfillment of our life, is something that's happening in each moment. And it's that our life is fully expressed right here in whatever stage we're at. And so the challenge maybe of that Dogen is offering here is, what is it to fully occupy the stage I'm at right now? You know, I was saying the other day that I was on the East Coast and doing this retreat with my old friend, and she had these old pictures of us when we were in college. And so we were looking at these pictures, and I thought, wow, who are these people? Who are these babies, you know? And 22 years ago, and it was like, you know, a different person. And I think we've aged decently well, but, you know, it was like, that doesn't feel like me. And the me who I am now, according to Dogen, strictly speaking, is not related to, you know, I'm not a future version of that 20-year-old. I'm completely who I am now. And this challenge of, what is it to fully experience ourselves where we are, not as part of a sequence, but just this, you know? So firewood is totally firewood. It can never be anything but firewood. Ash is totally ash. Can never be anything but ash. So health does not turn into sickness. Each has its own whole existence. Youth does not become old age. For Dogen, when we're young, life is fully that. I mean, I think in a way this is easy to see when you, if we think about children or look at children, or babies or children, we don't look at children as like being somewhat deficient adults, right? You know, child is a child. A child's completely a child. A child has its own mentality, its own way of seeing the world, its own complete perfect expression. It's not like, yeah, this kid is good, but they just need to like live for 30 more years and then they'll be okay. You know, it's like a child is completely a child. And maybe it's harder when we, You know, we're human beings who have our own memory and have our own sense of continuity. So to look in the mirror and not remember, oh, wait, you know, I'm a little different than I was 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 15 years ago. But so I think this is the flavor of what Dogen is getting at, that we can experience time as a flow, but it's important to be able to see the kind of that that each moment has its own fulfillment. And when Dogen talks about meditation, this becomes very important. You know, so he says that meditation practice is not a process of going from delusion to enlightenment. And this is very hard for us, I think, you know, to understand that it's that actually each moment of practice is its own completion, its own fulfillment. So the practice of Genjo Koan, to fully be, to fully occupy whatever stage we're at right now. I have my wife's niece is 19 years old, if you can remember. I mean, some of us here are close to that age, but some of us, it's a while ago, 19. And she's coming to live with us. Well, she's from Japan. She's coming to live with us and wants to come to college here and learn English really well. And when I talk to her, I can just see those gears. Like, she's so, she's thinking about the future. She's so in this mode of becoming and wondering what she'll become and wanting to shape her life. And it's beautiful, and it feels very appropriate and beautiful. And painful and stressful. And, you know, we can remember of, you know, being that age and all of the unknowability, all of the uncertainty, all of the doubt and the hope and the fear and the, and so what is it to fully be where we are? You know, and sometimes I say to her, just enjoy, just be a student and enjoy it. Being a student is the best thing, you know. You don't have responsibilities, you don't have, you know, just have fun and enjoy, and don't think about the future so much, and don't. So Dogen says, when we find our place where we are, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. So what is it in the most simple, plain way to be willing to be where we are, to be willing to be who I am in this moment? This is Genjo Koan. I think when I talk about this kind of topic of impermanence and time and birth and death, I often think of my friend Phyllis, who we were in the Buddhist chaplaincy program together here, you know, our IMC, about 13 years ago. And Phyllis was a wonderful person. She was in her 70s. She had had a very interesting life. She was from a generation where she wasn't encouraged that much to go to school. But it turned out she was quite brilliant, and she kind of fought for the opportunity to go to college, go to graduate school. She did different things. She lived on Mount Madonna for a while with a guru. I forget who it is on Mount Madonna, you know, in the 80s. She became a therapist, and in our Buddhist chaplaincy, she was very focused. She said, "I'm here for one reason. I want to work with returning veterans who have PTSD. And that was her intention. And I want to bring this kind of Buddhist orientation to this. And this is how I want to serve. And so we did this program together for a year and we became friends and close. And a couple of years after the program, she was diagnosed with brain cancer. And it was kind of surprising because she was so healthy and vigorous. And she was told that there was no point in doing any treatment. And she had, you know, just a few months to live. And she decided, she said, I am going to live my life to the fullest for whatever time I have left. And then when I feel like I'm losing myself and I'm losing my brain and my quality of life, I'm going to pull the plug. And she kind of figured out how she could do that and basically end her life on her terms. But she said to herself, you know, this is a pretty radical thing or pretty, you know, pretty big thing. I should talk to someone. So she called Gil up, you know, as our teacher, and she explained a little bit about what was going on, and she went down to Redwood City and met with Gil to kind of see, in a way, get his blessing for this plan. And I asked Gil, you know, what happened or how did it go? And he said, when I met Phyllis and when I spent this time with Phyllis, I thought that this is the happiest person I have ever met in my life. You know, there was something about her that was just radiant, just glowing, that she was, in some way, she was freed, you know, to have this diagnosis and have this sort of endpoint. It just cut off the future. And in cutting off the future, it cut off the past. And she was just here. She was present. And she was thrilled. She was so happy. Like, she didn't have to hold anything back anymore. She didn't have to save any piece of herself. She could be so fully alive in this moment. And he said it was awesome to just be in her field. And, you know, and she had kind of devoted her life in various ways to practice, you know, to finding out who she was and being of service to others. And she was just, she was freed, you know, and she had a few more months. And then when she felt that the end was coming, she threw a huge party, had all her friends there, played one last round of cards, you know, of gin rummy with her girlfriends, and that was it. That was it. And I want to be careful not to say that there's a good way of, we're so into, you know, doing things the right way. We even want to die the right way. The good death or the perfect death or something. And, you know, she's just one example and one example, but this idea of time being something that, in a way she flipped over, I think, to this, that she could realize the fulfillment of her life right here, right now, in this moment, this present moment, which for Dogen, the present moment is absolute. It's not a unit of time. So I think one of the blessings of this way of understanding time is that it imbues or can imbue what is ordinary with a sense of the sacred. You know, the kind of, I think about this Japanese expression, ichigo ichie, And ichi means one. And so literally this means one time, ichigo, and then ichie, one meeting, one time, one meeting. Suzuki Roshi translated this as once in a lifetime, this one encounter. Once in a lifetime, this one encounter. What is it to meet our life with the understanding that things only happen once? You know, we feel like things repeat over and over and over again. But that might be because we're not looking carefully enough. We're not close enough. You know, so this experience of things only happen once, and the kind of poignancy of that. I mean, I think about it with my kids, even in just being away for a few days and coming home. They look different. They've changed. They're older. They're more cynical. They're like, oh, hi, Papa. No big hug. You know, but it's like moment by moment, everything is changing. And moment by moment, everything is fully, completely this. And all it can ever be is this. Just this. Just this. Just this. I wanted to end with this. It's another story of transitioning at the end of life. And this is the account of the musician Lou Reed. And, you know, he had cancer and passed away a number of years ago. And his wife, Lori Anderson, wrote this. And they're both practitioners. She said, I have never seen an expression as full of wonder as Lou's as he died. His hands were doing the water flowing 21 form of Tai Chi. His eyes were wide open. I was holding in my arms the person I loved the most in the world and talking to him as he died. His heart stopped. He wasn't afraid. I had gotten to walk with him to the end of the world. Life, so beautiful, painful, and dazzling, does not get better than that. And death, I believe that the purpose of death is the release of love. So everything, absolutely everything, is its own moment. It's occupying its own place, its own time. It's kind of like this impossibility of becoming. This is Suzuki Roshi. The sun-faced Buddha is good. The moon-faced Buddha is good. Whatever it is, that is good. all things are Buddha, and there is no Buddha. If I suffer while I am dying, that is suffering Buddha, and there is no confusion in it. Maybe everyone will struggle because of physical agony or spiritual agony, but that is not a problem. We should be very grateful to have a limited body like yours or mine. If you had a limitless life, it would be a great problem for you. One of the things I most appreciate about this orientation to life is that Suzuki Roshi says, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha does not mean to be indifferent. It means that whatever it is, we just enjoy it. And enjoyment, in this sense, doesn't mean we just put a happy face on everything. You know, enjoyment includes the full range of our emotions. You know, so he says, if you are attached to something, be attached to something completely. If you're attached to something, be attached to something completely. One of the most beautiful and powerful moments for me is being in the presence of someone who is so fully expressing their grief, who's so raw, so 100%, 1,000% grieving. The kind of primal emotion. There's no confusion in that. You know, I am here. Boom, sun-faced Buddha. Boom, moon-faced Buddha. This confidence is important. You know? So let's just sit for a minute. Firewood becomes ash, and it does not become firewood again. And yet, do not suppose that the ash is future and the firewood past. You should know, you should understand, that firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood. Ash abides in the phenomenal expression of ash. Birth is an expression, complete this moment. Youth is an expression, complete this moment. Health, sickness, old age, all expressions completely themselves. have the courage and the confidence to fully occupy wherever we are, whatever mind state, whatever self state, whatever moment, to fully occupy who and what we are, right here, right now. Nothing is missing.